I feel very strongly against all forms of violence against women, and I feel that this should be addressed by the International Criminal Court.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Delegates from United Nations member nations meet in Rome in June and July 1998 to finalize a treaty creating a new institution, an International Criminal Court. To uphold the interests of women in the formation of this court, women from around the world organized a lobbying organization. In April, some members of this Caucus for Gender Justice held an International Women's Roundtable to lay their issue before the public and the press.
Good morning. I'm Lena Giacomopoulou, a United Nations radio producer, a women's weekly program that goes around the world. And today we have members of the Women's Caucus for Gender Justice for the International Criminal Court. This is the final meeting before going to Rome, where the treaty for the International Criminal Court is expected to be adopted. Now we're going to Alda Fascio, who's the director of the Women's Caucus, and she's going to give us a roundup of this last meeting, which was took place at United Nations headquarters, and she will tell us what were the achievements and perhaps what were the obstacles in terms of women's issues.
The Women's Caucus was formed because the women's concerns were not being taken up by the NGOs that were lobbying for the interests of civil society in the criminal court, and neither were the delegates. So the Women's Caucus was formed to negotiate and lobby for women's interests and women's concerns to be taken into account in the statute, which is the treaty that will create the court. And we've been working since last February. We've had many successes that are still, some of them are still bracketed. Bracketed means that it's still, bracketed language means that it's still being negotiated, and we could lose what we have gained. So we really need the support of women and men around the world to lobby their governments, lobby the ministries of foreign affairs and of justice to help us get the language that we need and the issues that we need to be in the statute to remain there in Rome.
If there was one issue that was really very important in terms of this criminal court, is it rape? Is it the issue of rape? Is it the protection of the witnesses? Is it representation?
The one issue that I really feel that most women can relate to and that was discussed at this PrepCon is the issue of mainstreaming of gender, of a gender perspective into the statute, the balancing of men and women in the court, and having expertise on gender violence within the members of the court and within the staff. That is something that women have fought for since this human rights movement began. We have been calling for mainstreaming of gender into all human rights treaties. We have been calling for the end of impunity to violence against women and accountability from governments. And governments have committed to these things, and so we really want them to comply with these issues and others that I will have the other members of the caucus talk to.
My name is Kathy Hall Martinez. I am a supporter of the Women's Caucus and a staff attorney with an NGO called the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy here in New York. And basically, the notion that Alda is referring to, the mainstreaming of gender, really permeates, of course, the whole conception of a new international institution. And this is really an historic opportunity to further gains that women made in Vienna and in Beijing. Gender issues need to be part and parcel of every international institution. And specifically, the Women's Caucus believes that there needs to be not only staff members that are women and members of the court judges that are women, but that also, you know, women's concerns would be integrated into all of the different parts of the statute, everything from issues related to victims and witnesses, issues related to sexual violence, all of these things women have fought for in other fora and that need to be furthered.
Maybe Rhonda Copeland, who's the convener.
Okay, I'm Rhonda Copeland, and I'm a professor of law at the City University of New York. And I direct the International Women's Human Rights Law Clinic, which has been the legal secretariat for the caucus, which means that many of the members here have been involved and in other places have been involved in drafting and vetting and giving their ideas into our documents, and we sort of end up putting them together. Your question about what's the most important, what we're always saying to the delegates is we can't have one without the other. In other words, I think that when they gave us rape as a grave breach of the Geneva Conventions, which means that they moved the understanding of sexual violence from humiliating and degrading treatment, that was extraordinarily soundly rejected in December, to looking at it as amongst the most serious crimes. And also, we believe the statute contains an understanding that it's not only amongst the most serious crimes, but rape can be torture, can be enslavement, can be, and we have the terms rape, sexual slavery, enforced prostitution, enforced pregnancy, and enforced sterilization, and other serious forms of sexual violence. So we've really expanded that. They think that that's enough, they can go home, and they've done their thing for women. We've said, no, if you don't have a court that is permeated with an understanding of what gender is, of how you have to reinterpret law, on how you have to rethink proof, on how you have to think about the rules of procedure and evidence differently, on how you have to deal with victims and witnesses differently, then it doesn't matter that rape is in the statute. And we have the examples of that from the International Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia and for Rwanda. If it weren't for the mobilization of women's human rights NGOs and the survivor community to insist that rape and sexual violence would be considered, and if it weren't that there were not some people within the tribunal, a legal advisor on gender, which is a position we fight to have in the statute now, there would not have been attention to rape, even amongst the most well-meaning people. And it's not always the most well-meaning. We also know that despite all of our work, the attitude that sexual violence is trivial compared to other kinds of violations still is a very commonly held position. And so this statute is really part of putting that and the mechanisms for making that real, and making that really happen in a justice system. It's a mechanism for putting that on the table and creating not only an international criminal court that will hear very few cases and only the most extreme situations, but it's also a mechanism for creating a model that countries can follow. If you can't introduce evidence of prior sexual conduct in a rape trial in the International Criminal Court, it sets a standard for what you should be doing in domestic courts. So it's got very large implications for the human rights work of women in their countries, as well as our efforts to bring the violations of women and gender violations into the international sphere.
The presence of the women in the ICC is historical too, because the delegates are starting to understand that gender is not a narrow category that just refers to women, but refers to the power relationship that you can also link it to the power that is between the countries as well. My name is Ana Elena Oando. I am from Costa Rica. I am also part of the Women Caucus. I'm part of the Inter-American Consultation for Women Human Rights Activists. It's an organization in Latin America. So I will say that for us, there is not a main issue important. There are several issues. For example, we can say that there is an important issue in defining and also in putting the language in the statute about sexual and gender crimes. In procedure, for example, we also have protection of witnesses and victims. We also have ought to have a principle of non-discrimination. And in composition and administration, you know, as I explained it before, we have the balance, the gender balance, you know, between men and women. So for us, there is not like one important issue, because what we think is that gender, you know, as a broader category, encompass everything and is global. And one of the obstacles we have had and we have found here in the delegation is the lack of understanding of the gender perspective.
So we have been doing a lot of lobbying, but also educating the delegates about what gender is and the implication of gender. That is part of the importance of the Women Caucus of being in this court.
I wonder if we could discuss a little bit the situation in Rwanda, because we have had many victims discussing the issue of Rwanda and the victim protection, that the women feel very frightened to go to Arusha and give witness. They say they're not well prepared, they say they're shy, they say they're frightened, and they're also frightened of going back to their country when some of them have been killed for giving witness. Would anyone like to talk a little bit about that and what advances we've had in terms of the criminal court? Could you identify?
Sure. My name is Valerie Osterveld, and I'm from the International Center for Human Rights and Democratic Development, which is based in Canada. This center has been working with Rhonda Copeland's clinic and with other NGOs, and has a monitor based in Kigali, in Rwanda. And we've been following the situation at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda for quite some time. It is very worrisome. In Rwanda, witnesses are being killed for even being potential witnesses. So, for example, if investigators from the Rwanda Tribunal come and speak to them, then their lives are in danger, even if they have not agreed to testify at the tribunal. And we're particularly concerned about rape victims who have been asked to testify, not only because there was a mass rape that happened in Rwanda and there are potentially many, many witnesses, but also because it's so important to bring forward this evidence to the International Criminal Tribunal, and we don't want the women to be intimidated into not testifying. So there is a victims and witnesses unit there. We do, however, have concerns about how it is being operated and whether or not it's providing the kind of protection that women in particular need, and follow-up protection. There is now an expert on sexual and gender crimes there. She's just begun her work, so we have to work with her to make sure that this is hopeful and helpful.
Would that be the same situation in Yugoslavia, former Yugoslavia? As you know, women are giving witness, the proceedings are taking place in The Hague.
It's a very serious problem because the tribunal is incapable of providing really adequate witness protection. And that leads, on the one hand, to the need to allow witnesses to testify anonymously, which is a controversial subject, which will be a very controversial subject in regard to the rules of procedure in this proceeding. And in the former Yugoslavia tribunal, they have decided that sometimes they will give anonymity and sometimes they won't. And what has happened is that women who have not been given anonymity have been unwilling to testify. I've talked with women who live in Bosnia, you know, and the situation is even more extreme in Rwanda, where the towns are even smaller. These women in both places are living right in the same towns with their perpetrators, with the people who raped them. And it's the same in Haiti as well. And the situation for the women is when they see the person who raped them, it's they run to hide. It's not the perpetrator that runs to hide. And the issue of how you do this needs a great deal of attention. And I would say it's an issue for all witnesses, the danger of testifying, the humiliation question. In the society, I met with a couple of young Bosnian women who were raped during the war about 6 months ago, and they said they can be humiliated so quickly when there's knowledge of what happened to them, and there's this incredible strength in the women to keep going, and there is always this underlying fear. So I think that it's a very serious question. It's one that requires a great deal of attention, requires serious resources, and requires expertise in gender and sexual violence to solve it. But you can't have a fair tribunal without having witnesses willing to testify. And I think that there are people who realize that, but it's got to be on the front burner in the UN system, or it's not going to happen.
A very practical question. The International Criminal Court is going to try cases which occurred during war, right, armed conflict.
No, we don't want to see it confined to that. And it's an important question. You raise the question of rape as a crime against humanity. and sexual violence as crimes against humanity, that the only category of crimes that will be clearly within the jurisdiction of the court that will apply to civil society, not necessarily in internal or external armed conflict, is crimes against humanity. And one of the things that's extremely important in the negotiation that will take place in Rome, it's not coming up here, is that crimes against humanity be recognized as separate from armed conflict. Crimes against humanity are widespread or systematic commission of terrible atrocities, which the list of which includes sexual violence, torture, mutilation, etc. And it's also persecution. Persecution based on a number of categories of social group. The traditional categories are race, ethnicity, politics, and religion, which comes out of the Nuremberg tribunals. We're seeking, and it's in brackets, as Alde explained in the document, to add gender to the bases of persecution. And that allows for looking at extreme levels of deprivation of rights and of discrimination against women. It's not a case where any issue of discrimination would be able to come before the International Criminal Court, but it does open it up for civil society wrongs, not simply war wrongs. And for the Women's Caucus, that's a very important issue for people listening who are going to go out and mobilize and lobby. That's another one of the very, very important issues that's on the Rome agenda.
Would you consider, for instance, female genital mutilation, would that be something that a group of women could file in the International Criminal Court, for instance, as a systematic persecution? Does anyone want to address that? Or if it's not female genital mutilation, could you maybe cite another very specific persecution that occurs to women specifically? Because it has to be systematic, right? It cannot be an individual case. Could you identify yourself?
I'm Cristina Rosario Gates from the Philippines. And I'll make a connection with your question later. But I would just like to advance the idea that the world has a lot of catching up to do, because I feel that an international criminal court, had it been implemented or created 50 years ago, then justice could have been given, particularly to women victims of the Pacific War. I am here basically because I'm involved with the Asian Comfort Women, Filipino Comfort Women. I do rehabilitative counseling work with them, and I was able to unearth a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder, personalization disorder, dissociative disorders amongst these survivors 50 years after the war. In other words, this woman has not only suffered actual victimization during the war, but even the period covering the 50-year invisibility of their wartime ordeal is characterized by the continuing trauma, nightmares, and intrusive remembrances of their experiences in war. What I did was to document my findings and come up with some kind of a report, and I submitted this, appeared in the Japanese District Court to sort of lobby for the compensation of these women. Since historical documents point to accountability of the Japanese government, it's like fighting an uphill battle because we're going up against the Japanese government, and yet the case is lodged in the Japanese District Court. And this is where that I really feel acutely the need for an international criminal court, and that this court should pay attention to gender issues, particularly to women. Secondly, I'd like to make a point, and because I work in the area of violence against women in war and peace conditions, I could see the continuing thread between the wartime victimization of these Asian Comfort Women with ongoing acts of violence against women in the present form in terms of domestic violence, and it do appear in court, in the domestic court, as well as an expert witness involving battered wives and battered children. And aside from domestic violence, there is an insidious form of violence which my colleague from Poland, Eleonora, and I have been discussing, and this concerns the trafficking of women. And I'm not referring to trafficking of women, Asian women, to southern women to northern countries, but really with a globalized economy, trafficking of women has likewise transcended national boundaries as well. I feel very strongly against all forms of violence against women, and I feel that this should be addressed by the International Criminal Court. The gender issue cannot be trivialized, because I believe that gender equality will be one of the primary foundations of genuine global peace. And that's the reason why I'm here. And in sisterhood, I really try to work in solidarity with my colleagues in the Women's Caucus.
My name is Angela Agwawike. I'm a journalist from Nigeria, but I'm here for the Constitutional Rights Project from Lagos, Nigeria. When we talk about female genital mutilation, I think we'll be happy to see it as a crime before the International Criminal Court, because it is violence against women. But the thing is, who are you going to hold responsible? Because no government in Africa, at least from the part of Africa where I come from, where they practice female genital mutilation, no government is officially in support of it. It's a cultural practice which some families do on their own. Even if when the society frowns on it, you find them doing it, and it's being done by the women. So who are you going to hold responsible? Are you going to take the leader of that country or the leader of the community who might not have known anything about it? So I think that's going to make it very, very difficult if we want it to be a crime before the ICC. But I think we'll love it if there's a way it can come there, because like the Filipino comfort women, women who go through female genital mutilation also have this stress, psychological, social, everything. You know, they go through all these things. Maybe later in life, they can't cope with married life. They can't cope with sexual activity in a married relationship. So it still has its impact on them. And because of that, we want it before the ICC. Maybe we'll have to find a way to do that. Right now, we don't have the answer to how to do it.
I know the UNHCR, which is the UN Refugee Agency, acknowledges that female genital mutilation is in fact persecution and allows political asylum. So this would be a step forward, I would think, legally.
Yeah, I think so. And at least back in Nigeria, there are some organizations that are solely concerned, not only in Nigeria, in the whole of Africa. It's called the Inter-African Committee Against Harmful Traditional Practices to Women. They've been doing a lot of work in this area, but the thing is, they have not been able to get the government to pass a legislation, you know, a general legislation, maybe like national, condemning female genital mutilation and making it a criminal offense. But in some of the regions, yes, they are criminal offense, but how do you get the people? That's still the problem. Because a woman gives birth to her baby, takes the baby to another woman next door, and they do it. So you never get to know unless that person, maybe there's an enlightened person from that family who comes up and talks about it. So if we can, maybe the association back home or all over Africa, all over the world, can come up and, you know, try to persecute these cases, so they bring it out to the international community, maybe register it with the UNHCR, then we'll be able to make it a crime. But right now, it's very difficult to make a crime back home.
Did you want to say something, Rona Copeland?
The difference between the trafficking question and the female genital mutilation question in terms of the court are good examples. I think, and the difference between persecution and the refugee situation is, there the focus is totally on the victim, right? Who's doing what to her? It's not who's doing it. It's what's happening to her. In a criminal proceeding, the focus is more largely on who's doing it. So the issue of widespread and systematic applies to the question of who. And I think Angela's right that so many of the crimes against women occur as a result of culture and through private hands, that there are only some of them where they're organized enough that are likely to be candidates for the International Criminal Court. On the other hand, if violence against women is viewed as grave violence and is before the International Criminal Court, it's a cultural changing phenomenon, so that then you can talk about female genital mutilation and what it does and the way it's like those terrible things that happen in conflict or those terrible things that constitute crimes against humanity. So it changes. It's part of changing the discourse, the way in which people think about violence, and has
at least a trickle-down effect for issues like female genital mutilation, dowry, death, many, you know, domestic violence, which is the worldwide, you know, customary form of violence against women. I think it can have an impact, even if there's no person we can single out to say, okay, you're the perpetrator of widespread and systematic. At least at this point, it could change over time.
Would you like to add something?
I wanted to add something. My name is Donna Axel, and I'm the project's coordinator for the Women's Caucus for Gender Justice. And it seems like this morning we've heard about a couple of the issues that are of great concern to the Women's Caucus. One is, in general terms, looking at women suffering, for example, crimes of sexual and gender violence. And the other is looking at women and people who have expertise in those particular crimes to get into the place where they're within the court system, within this new permanent court, so they have some ability to affect how these crimes are prosecuted. And what we've seen across the street is that a lot of the delegates are interested to hear more about women as victims, but less likely to take an interest in the dialogue that looks at women as having a position of power, being part of the court system. And so we're still up against quite a battle as we go into Rome from June to July to try to have women seen as not just victims, but also as people who can be in power positions and affect the way these prosecutions take place.
Although the record so far isn't bad, the criminal court in The Hague, is the prosecutor is a woman, and there are several judges, so do you agree that several steps, good steps, have taken place already?
Well, of course there have been several steps, including I think some of the women and the women's groups here have participated in coming up with amicus curiae and submitting them to the different tribunals so that to sort of help them on their way. But there is much more that needs to be done.
This was the first of a two-part series of Women from the Caucus for Gender Justice discussing their efforts to uphold the interests of women in the creation of the new United Nations International Criminal Court. The final part of this discussion will be in next week's WINGS program. Meanwhile, you can get more information about the issues and the lobbying points for the meeting coming up in Rome by contacting the Caucus for Gender Justice.
Email address, it's ICC Women altogether. It means International Criminal Court Women, but it's ICCWomen@IGC.org.
IGC.org?
Yes.
Oh, great, okay.
And the address, in the mailing address, for those who still use the post, is 777 United Nations Plaza, care of the Jane Adams Peace Association, and I never know the zip code.
New York, 10017.
Can I just give that whole address again?
Sure, it's 777 UN Plaza, Jane Adams Peace Association, it's care of JAPA, and that's New York, 10017.
Thanks to Linda Hawk in Israel and the International Women's Roundtable, the Stanley Foundation, and Lena Yakimopoulou for their contributions to this program. I'm Frieda Worden for WINGS. Cassettes of both parts of the International Women's Roundtable titled Caucus for Gender Justice can be ordered for $15 from WINGS, P.O. Box 33220, Austin, Texas, 78764. That's $15 for both parts of the Caucus for Gender Justice. WINGS, Box 33220, Austin, Texas, 78764, USA. For more information, email wings@igc.org or look for our website, www.wings.org. WINGS is supported by local radio stations and individual contributors, including Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange. Thanks also to Suzette Cullen. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.